the local news hour this morning. I'm scheduled to talk with Summit County Councilmember Melina Stevens, taking a look at last night's meeting and public hearing with the Dakota Pacific Project. Ski Utah CEO Nathan Rafferty will be on the phone with a mid-season update on this winter's ski and ride season so far. And Heather Sims, the Youth Sports Alliance Youth Programs Director, has an update on some of the after-school programs they've got. Right now on the phone, we've got Drew Hardesty with Utah Avalanche Forecast Center.
Leslie, good morning. You know, quite a weather system that impacted the Wasatch yesterday and overnight. Temperatures reached into the 40s at some locations yesterday, and that even triggered some wet loose. I can't believe I'm saying this in January. Some wet loose avalanches at predominantly the lower elevation northerly aspects, maybe up to about even 8,500 feet, a little higher. And that wouldn't necessarily be cause for concern unless you are ice climbing in Little Cottonwood Canyon. And it couldn't be described any other way but harrowing experience of these ice climbers that were on route and saw the steam engine of wet debris coming down at them. And they suffered the onslaught without injury, but they certainly got off the route very quickly and then headed back to the vehicles. But with the cold front, that's all locked up and should be in the rearview mirror. With wind gusts exceeding 100 miles an hour in the midnight hours last night along the highest elevations and continued winds today, there will be what I'd call scattered patchwork hard slabs probably around the compass at the mid and upper elevations. It wouldn't be sensitive per se and more stubborn, but trickier. They may pull out on maybe the third skier or rider on the slope. This is only going to add insult and injury and additional stress to the old buried weak layers from November. So we're going to continue with considerable, once again, for the mid and upper elevations, generally low danger at the lowest elevations. But stay safe out there, and we'll hope for more storms in the future.
Okay. Thanks, Drew. Taking a look at some local news now, the Summit County Council last night heard from the public for the first time on the large Dakota Pacific residential commercial plan proposed for Kimball Junction. The council did not make a decision after a meeting that ran for more than 3 hours. KPCW's Rick Bruff reports the speakers who attended the meeting via Zoom were about evenly divided between opposition and support for the plan that's proposing some 1.3 million square feet, including 1,100 residential units.
The council heard from over 25 citizens during the hearing. Last fall, the project was sent on by the Snyderville Planning Commission with a negative recommendation by a 5-2 vote. The critics on Wednesday said that the Dakota plan is a big urban project that doesn't fit in a rural resort area. They said it will accelerate growth and add too much in population to Kimball Junction. Dakota's proposal would amend the Boyer-Tett Park plan approved 12 years ago. Among the comments, Kathy Becker said Dakota won't bring the kind of quality, high-paying jobs they were hoping for with the Tett Park. She also said Dakota's affordable housing won't be effective.
It's a cool, different kind of development, but I don't think it's one that isn't going to come. It's not going to provide more housing for teachers. I mean, teachers are lining up and they should get it. We're going to have a net decrease in this development affordable housing because we're creating a lot of low-income jobs, and that's going to greatly increase the number of commuters. That's just what's going to happen. Actually, I like that there's more apartments. I think all of those things are the mix that we need, but I don't think we should be giving points to this development as if it is solving a housing problem. It's actually not. It's a net decrease.
Becker added that while the sketches show connectivity in the development, that won't hold up during the winter months in Summit County. Another critic, Josh Mann, said they need a development that would bring diversity to the economy. In the last dozen years, only two buildings have been developed in the Tett Park, and Mann, agreeing with former County Council member Sally Elliott, said that Boyer hadn't done a very good job promoting the development. But even with that, Mann said the Tet Park has done well.
One of the fundamental failures here is that everybody looks at the Tet Park as a failure. The Tet Park actually has been a success. I mean, when you look at it, we got Skull Candy, we have open space, we got affordable housing, we have a transit center, we have roundabouts that then enabled Whole Foods and other economic things. We've got e-bikes. It's actually been a huge success at the Tet Park. And yes, would we want a few more Skull Candies? Of course. But could we really have survived if Adobe moved in 5,000 or 10,000 jobs? Probably not. We want it slow.
On the other hand, supporters said the affordable housing will make it possible for people to live here, whether they are employees or young people who have grown up in the county. Ryan Fish said his family has owned property here since the early 1980s. He has run a small service business for lodges and restaurants for 20 years, and his family now lives in Oakley. Fish said he changed his mind about the development.
At first, I was opposed to the growth and opposed to the idea of the growth, but as I spent time looking in more detail at the plan, I've come full circle and am fully supportive of the proposal because of several things. But the biggest issue I face as a small business owner in the area, like others have said, is finding and hiring employees who can work and live in the area. It's so hard to try and attract people from the valley to drive up to the Park City area every day. So I love the component of the affordable housing.
And John Butler is a Jeremy Ranch resident and says his family has roots in the county going back several generations.
This is one of the first projects that I've been involved with that takes into consideration the everyday family that wants to live here and try to make a difference, that wants to contribute to our local society. I'm not talking about the top of Deer Valley. I'm not talking about the second home or the third home owner. I'm talking about people that want to live here. The comments so far by those who oppose the development, I would love to challenge them. Where do your children go to school? Where do they hang out? What neighborhood recreation do they participate in? I'd love to hear that. I mean, because I may be blind to what the other people think. I'm looking for a place my children can call home. Not necessarily interested, you know, sorry to say this, to those people that are entitled to live here. You know, we live here, we work here. It's hard to live here.
Basin resident John Butler. For KPCW, I'm Rick Bruff.
Well, as we just reported, the Summit County Council meeting virtually yesterday, holding that public hearing on the Dakota Pacific project at Kimball Junction. Again, 1,100 units, a 130-room hotel, 160,000 square feet of office and retail use, totaling 1.3 million square feet of development at a very traffic-challenged intersection. On the phone with her take from last night's hearing, I have Summit County Council member Melina Stevens. Good morning, Melina.
Good morning, Leslie.
So regarding Dakota, you may be a first. We can't remember of a person in Summit County who's had to cast a deciding vote on a controversial development, not once, but twice. So I guess, how would you characterize the comments that you heard last night compared to what you heard as a Snyderville Basin Planning Commissioner last summer?
I think in looking at the comments, and we had multiple public hearings on the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission, there are some similar concerns that are still voiced by people that are not supportive of the development. I think we did get some new feedback last night, which was helpful, regarding different concerns and challenges and suggestions that would be helpful in making this project something that could be a benefit to the community. Overall, I think there's a contingent of citizens that are concerned that this will not benefit the community, but will detract from the community. And based on some other comments, there's a contingent of citizens that believe that there will be some benefits to the community per this this project or something like it if it were to be approved. I know there was a suggestion last night that encouraged additional public outreach, and I thought that was a very interesting and would be a very helpful way to continue this conversation and get some more input. There was a lot of people from last night that had commented both on Planning Commission during those public hearings, as well as now at the county level, which is fantastic that we have so many people that are following this. I personally would love to hear additional people and get a broader swath of the community involved so that we can really get a pulse on where the community as a whole is at with the project.
Now, while as a member of the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission, you were one of the two to forward a positive recommendation of the project onto the county council. Last night, though, you said it's not quite there yet. So was it there when you saw it as a planning commissioner?
So as a planning commissioner, we were instructed that we were looking at if the uses would be appropriate. I believed that the uses would be appropriate as a council person, and per even what Roger Armstrong last night had indicated, that this really would be more appropriately handled through opening the development agreement if the applicant is willing and open to that, so that we can address kind of all of the issues, ensure that there's consistency, and make sure that we as a community are really getting what we are intending if this were to be approved.
Yeah, so I guess what did you mean, though, especially in regards to the affordable housing there?
With the affordable housing, I think it's critical that, and I stated this on Planning Commission as well, I think it's critical that we have affordable housing in different housing types. And so the rental component and ensuring that we have additional rentals, to me, is very intriguing, because that is a product type that we don't have a lot of within the basin or just the Park City area in general. So many of those have been taken up by nightly rentals that were long-term leases previously. And so having something that is and stays rental, I think would also be a community benefit, because if those people had to stay there as primary residents, I think that could really improve some of our ability to house workers at all levels, even those that make above the levels that would be required within affordable housing.
Yeah, and I guess I'm kind of hearing some conflicting reports there. I mean, we hear it's a place, you know, one of the commenters last night that we just reported on, you know, it's a place where families are going to live. And yet others say there's going to be so much going on here. It's going to be such a busy, loud neighborhood that it's not ideal for a family. So I guess what is it? And I guess we really don't know until it's built. But still, I mean, are people, I think, maybe under the wrong impression that this is going to be a family neighborhood?
Well, and I think, Leslie, I think that as a planning commission and now as a council is what we're trying to determine. Because if it's going to just be a loud, busy area that's really not creating a sense of place and a sense of community, that's not having community benefits broadly as well as for those that are living within the neighborhood, then it's not likely to be something that we need to have within this community. I think that right now we do have people on both sides of the fence as far as this is concerned, those that believe it would have community benefits, those that believe it would not. I think that we have some ways to go, and I appreciated Bob Richer's comments last night that you know, with this project, that something likely will go here at some point, that we need to be careful and ensure that we are approaching this in a way that will provide community benefit, and that as we look at, you know, if approved, or as we get to that point, that we're being really intentional with phasing, because we heard a lot of comments last night regarding the impacts during construction, not to mention the impacts once it's fully built out.
Dakota's proposal technically is amending the tech park approval. There's some suggestion now that the county should go back and revise the entire development agreement. What's your take on that?
I think it would be helpful to open the development agreement per Roger Armstrong's initial comments last night. And I heard from other members of the council that would be something they'd find interesting, that we need to make sure that the development agreement itself is consistent, and so we don't have any holes that allow for unintended consequences. I think we want to be as intentional as possible. I know initially there was a lot of intention behind the tech park agreement, and I think if there is to be a change to the agreement that we need to be just as intentional now with what we are trying to accomplish and what this community is envisioning as they were when this tech park agreement was originally enacted.
Yeah. What about the transit improvements to Kimball Junction? Do you agree with the developer who says that Dakota could be the catalyst for UDOT to get some kind of traffic improvements going?
I think that there is a possibility of that. Having a larger group of people right there and some new construction and revitalizing the area may be appealing to UDOT. I don't know. Not sure of what type of connections may be there as well to be able to assist the county in moving some of these projects, such as this one, up the list to improve. So honestly, Leslie, I'm not sure if that would be something that would happen. I think there's a possibility there, but it's too soon to tell.
Yeah, because the critics are saying we should really, you know, we should find out what UDOT, when will UDOT will do something before approving the development, but that's not going to happen, it sounds like.
Well, and per some of our conversations last night, I think there will be some ongoing conversations with the applicant regarding transit and some of these improvements to UDOT as well. So we'll see where we land on that, but we're still a little bit premature with that, I think.
So what's next here? I mean, do we have another public hearing? Do we talk about reopening the development agreement? I mean, are we close to making some kind of approval or decision, I guess?
I know Tom Fisher last night indicated that they want to keep this on the forefront, that they don't want to drag this out. So I would assume that we would hear this for multiple meetings over the next couple of months. I would assume that we would have additional public hearings at this point. I'm not certain if and when those are scheduled, but I personally would like to hear more from the public regarding their opinions and their concerns with this project. And I'm sure that we will have continuous conversations regarding opening the development agreement, seeing if the applicant is amenable to that type of conversation. Last night with the meeting going until 9:30 at that point, I think my sense was that we wanted to be able to start fresh and all be at our best to be able to start those conversations with the applicant.
All right. Speaking of UDOT, there was a presentation of the Kimball Area Plan. The council was shown four alternatives for changes or improvements to the Kimball Junction area. At first blush, was there an alternative that you're leaning toward?
I think that the alternatives, there was a couple of alternatives that made some improvements to the intersections at Ute Boulevard and Olympic Parkway. And I found those very intriguing because those are some choke points right now that we have that are not working effectively currently. So I would like to see an option that either incorporates some changes to those intersections or changes those intersections so that we can have an easier flow of traffic in and out of 224, not just kind of the freeway on and off ramps.
Councilmember Glenn Wright mentioned briefly that Alternative 2, which is basically has a high occupancy vehicle, an HOV road, starting on Kilby Road just west of Powder Road, then running behind Powderwood and through to the Dakota Project, and then on to 224 south of the Olympic Parkway, is getting some flack. What are you hearing? Is this dead on arrival here?
You know, I personally haven't heard any comments regarding that particular part of this project thus far. I know there were concerns that were voiced, I believe, by Glenn, that there might be some issues with the easement or that it may be too close to the easement. And so there may be some concerns with that. I'm not sure I don't believe it's dead upon arrival. I think that they're still working on it. Will that be the option that's chosen? I don't know. It was not my favorite option of the four that were presented. I'm not sure where other council members landed.
Yeah, because we had also heard from Wendy Fisher from Utah Open Land saying that the roads in that plan would intrude on the High Ute open space, the PRI open space, as well as the Millennium Trail.
And I don't think it's not our intention to impede on rights of way or easements that are had by members of our community and that are expected. So I think that there is some more work to do. I know that these are still preliminary and that they're still massaging these out. So we'll see kind of where they land and if there's opportunity to be able to still employ something similar in those plans. I'm sure they'll look at that, but I think that's the purpose of having the four different options is to just give an idea broadly of what could take place, not what necessarily will take place because we're not sure yet.
Okay. And again, this will come back to the council for further investigation or discussion.
Yes.
Okay. Finally, just wanted to ask, what committees or boards were you assigned to for this year?
So I'll be participating with arts, also with the legislature, be involved in UAC, some of the financial committees for the county as well. So I will be kept very busy, and I'm excited to be able to contribute and learn and work with the fantastic staff and other elected officials that we have within the county and also with our nonprofits and other elected officials throughout the county.
Yeah. And I'd heard that we need to do a new group photo of the new council. I mean, are you going to get photoshopped in, or are we actually going to try and do something socially distanced?
You know, we're still working that out. So more news on that to come, Leslie.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention, Melina?
Well, thank you for having me, and thank you to the staff and all of those members of the community that contributed last night to our public hearing. It's really critical, and I know that there's been lots of people that have been involved in this from the beginning and for a long time, and I really personally appreciate all of their contributions, all of their insights, and their willingness to participate in the public process. So thank you to the community, and thank you to staff for all of their hard work.
All right. Melina Stevens, Summit County Councilmember, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
New Utah Governor Spencer Cox has presented his first budget proposal, which focuses on pandemic relief and further developing rural infrastructure. Cox, a Republican, stressed the importance of equity as he unveiled the proposed $21.7 billion budget earlier this week. The proposal would allocate at least $250 million towards fighting the coronavirus pandemic, $125 million on rural infrastructure, including expanding broadband access and electric vehicle charging stations. The budget also includes a boost in education funding for higher education and K-12 schools. Cox says he supports putting $112 million towards providing $1,500 bonuses for all the teachers in the state. University of Utah President Ruth Watkins has announced she's stepping down in April after accepting the position of president of Strata Impact. The national organization based in Indianapolis is dedicated to strengthening pathways between education and employment. Watkins made the announcement earlier this week, ending her three-year tenure at the Salt Lake City School, where she was the first woman named president of the university. The Utah Board of Higher Education will begin a national search for her replacement. It will also select an interim president if Watkins' successor is not selected before her departure. 8:32 now, good morning. Well, the holiday period didn't break any visitation records, but demand across the country appears to be solid for skiing and riding, as well as here in Utah. In the studio now with a mid-season report, I have the CEO of Ski Utah, Nathan Rafferty. Good morning.
Morning, Leslie.
So how would you describe Utah's holiday ski season?
You know, I would describe it as better than expected. So the, you know, like you said, demand is clearly there. You know, I think it's following on the heels of what we saw this summer. People want to get outside, and there are a very limited amount of activities that you can do. Not many people are going to movies or concerts, or things aren't keeping them off the slope. So there's a lot of demand to be outside with friends and family in the mountains.
Yeah, and we've expected Utah resorts to take a hit in revenue this season compared to last. Any insight on what those holiday numbers look like
yet? You know, we don't see specific numbers, but the resorts, we had a great call with all the resorts together just the other day, and certainly revenue numbers are down. A bunch of revenue streams are, you know, gone missing more or less, but the one that has not is the demand for just for lift tickets and being on the hill. So we're certainly seeing people out there.
So where we're seeing the revenue hits are food and beverage, lessons, rentals, things like that?
You're exactly right. And I think they said, you know, for the most part, they said that though, even those spots were a little bit better than they had expected, but they weren't expecting much this year, to be frank. And, you know, the real takeaway from the holiday is that, you know, if we can get through that holiday with that increased amount of people and kind of a limited amount of terrain, then I think it kind of proves that, you know, we can make the rest of this season happen really well. And the resorts have been working really hard. And I certainly have to give a shout out statewide, but especially here in Park City, the amount of terrain that is open at Park City and Deer Valley with the limited amount of natural snowfall is just astonishing to me. I'm not sure we would have even had a lift turning during the Christmas break if we didn't have snowmaking capability. So it's pretty amazing what's available out there, and the product has been great.
Yeah, certainly not the best snow on earth that Utah's known for. So how big of a hit do you think that'll have on the season if things don't change quickly?
You know, there's one thing that does not change, COVID or not, with our ski industry, and that's if it snows, people come skiing. So it's both a blessing and a curse. Certainly we want more people to ski, and we all want more powder to ski on, but it has helped moderate numbers a little bit. You know, we all know what that powder panic is like, and so not having that associated with the holiday wasn't the worst thing in the world. Again, we all want to ski powder, and I'm sure it's on the way. It sounds like there's some snow coming next week.
So with the when the 2020 season shut down mid-March last year, Ski Utah said that there was an estimated $232 million lost by resorts in revenue. But still, it was the state's fourth best winter for skier visits. So if this season doesn't get cut short, I mean, do you think we could come close to the pre-pandemic one?
This year? No, not even, you know, I don't think so. I think that's really unlikely. The goal for us this year was to get open, stay open, and if we stay open and offer skiing and riding throughout the entire season this year, we're going to consider that a success. And these resorts have worked really hard to make that happen, putting all these protocols in place. And I'm really pleased with where we are at the moment. We've still got a bunch of the season left.
So the holiday season, of course, was still the first major test of how our resorts' COVID-related policies are working. If you were to grade them, I mean, what grade would you give them?
You know, I'd give them somewhere near an A. Honestly, it's a struggle every day. They'll tell you that they have to be and have been extra diligent, asking people to please wear their masks. And you know, I think people understand now what's expected of them when they come skiing. And you know, every business, I think, will tell you that they're going to have some guests that show up and aren't ready or willing to comply with the rules. But across the board, all 15 of our resorts are taking absolutely hard stand, and with no exceptions. If you're not willing to wear a mask when you come to one of our Utah resorts, you are not welcome at that resort.
Yeah. Any story you can tell us about someone being a jerk and not abiding by the rules?
There are a handful for sure, and I don't know that I'd get into any in specific, but resorts have asked people to leave the property and escorted from the property if they're not willing to comply. And that's, you know, for everybody's benefit, the employees and all the other guests, and it makes perfect sense to me.
Yeah, we heard from some locals certainly concerned about the big crowds at Park City Mountain Resort over the holidays. And again, I think that has something to do with just the way the resort's laid out and the lack of terrain being open. I mean, did we see that in other resort areas?
You know, it was fairly busy statewide, and resorts are doing their best. And I think for the ones that I've talked to that have are working with their county health committees, that things are going really well. And so the controls the resorts put in place far exceeded the state of Utah's requirements. And you know, when you're outside and being distant, we really think that we're able to offer a very safe experience for guests.
Yeah, and we've had seasons like this with kind of low snow year, a lot of sunshine, a lot of high pressure. And so for people that are just like, okay, I'm not going to ski, we saw a lot of shopping on Main Street. I mean, how well boosted then, I guess, are some of the other amenities, you know, the ice skating, the outlet malls. Any idea about how they're doing?
You know, no, I'm not sure, but I just know anything outside it has been doing very well. And you know, at least we've had these great cold temps, which have allowed resorts to make snow. I saw the guys working on King's Crown over at Park City today. That looks like that's nearing completion. And again, these resorts have just been working double, triple, 10x hard to make some of these things available and operating. So, and it's been fun to be able, if it's not snowing, at least it's blue sky and we're out there enjoying the sun.
So in terms of your marketing this winter then, has it just been to our drive markets, you know, from Colorado, Nevada, California?
You know, we've shrunk that circle a little bit. Certainly we're marketing more to those drive markets, and our drive markets have expanded a little bit. So people are willing to drive a little bit farther. You know, I'm not the only one that sees Texas license plates in town. That's a haul, but people are doing it. So probably marketing a little bit less to our markets like Boston and New York and D.C. But like I said earlier, you know, demand is not small, and certainly locals coming out in force to get outside and recreate.
Yeah. So, I mean, in terms of your budget, how much have you cut back that marketing?
You know, we haven't cut that part of our budget back much at all. We knew that there was going to be you know, resorts are going to need all the help they can get. So we haven't done that. The state of Utah hasn't cut back. And we also want to put ourselves in the very best position that when we do get past this pandemic, that we are first in line to make sure people know we're open and operating and come back and visit, whether it's the springtime, summer, or teed up for next winter. We need to be ready to go once things get back to normal.
So you just kind of shifted the marketing dollars?
Yeah, a little bit. We've just moved it around a little bit, and certainly there are a lot of expenses that we've been able to shave a little bit as well.
Yeah. Legislature, of course, opening there's 45-day session next week. Any idea what we can expect in terms of those marketing dollars for the following season?
So far it looks really good. The governor's budget came out, and that was very positive. Again, that was just the governor's budget, so things tend to change pretty quickly up there. It's going to be an interesting legislative session just for the fact that it's remote, and you know, so much of that business gets taken care of person to person, bumping into people in the cafeteria, in the hall, and so we're going to have be extra diligent in listening into these committee meetings, making sure we touch base with people, phone and text, and it's going to be an interesting one to navigate.
Yeah. And then in terms of kind of our counterparts, I mean, what are you hearing from, Colorado and California?
You know, similar, although I'm on a weekly call with other state associations, so Colorado Ski Country, Ski California, you know, all these different regions. And I'll tell you that if you had to choose a state to do business in, especially ski business, Utah has got to be the one. You know, we are very business friendly, and especially during this pandemic, our state government has really put a focus on doing what we can in a safe manner to make sure our businesses are open. Places like Vermont really struggle with mandatory quarantines. If you want to go ski Vermont from outside of the state, you need to quarantine 2 weeks before you come out of your hotel room. And that's kind of a, you know, game changer for those guys. Whether everybody complies with that, I'm not sure, but you know, that's just an example of some of the rules and laws that other states are having to deal with that we aren't.
Yeah. Well, also they're not in the top five in terms of number of, you know, active cases either.
So. It cuts both ways. Yeah.
Okay. Hey, anything else you want to mention?
No, I'm just excited that the ski season is up and running. And like I said, I think it's moving forward better than we could have hoped. With the exception there being snow that we know is right around the corner. And again, just a shout out to all the snowmaking teams and all the resorts that are working hard to provide a great experience for everybody.
Okay. Nathan Rafferty, CEO of Ski Utah. Thanks.
Thanks.
Utah Avalanche Center presented a report on the state of the snowpack in Utah Tuesday night in partnership with the Park City Professional Ski Patrollers Association. KPCW's Sean Higgins reports that after last week's deadly avalanche just outside of the Park City Mountain Resort, the importance of avalanche education is front and center.
After an avalanche in the Dutch Draw backcountry area just outside the boundaries of Park City Mountain Resort resulted in the death of a 31-year-old Utah man last Friday, the dangers of backcountry skiing and riding were once again evident. Daily forecasts from the Utah Avalanche Center in the days leading up to the accident warned of unstable snow and dangerous conditions. Forecaster Drew Hardesty characterized people venturing out into the backcountry as, quote, rolling the dice and worried that luck would run out soon and a serious accident would occur. Unfortunately, luck did run out after a couple entered Dutch Draw through the access gates at the top of the 9990 chairlift. A 50-foot-wide slide was triggered, burying the victim. He was found several hours later, about 2 feet beneath the surface. At Tuesday's virtual State of the Snowpack presentation, Utah Avalanche Center forecaster Craig Gordon stressed the importance of understanding that once you cross the rope line separating the resort from the backcountry, you're on your own, no matter how close resort ski patrol might be.
What we have to realize, even though we can see it and they can see us, the patrol is responsible for the ski area boundary. And they're responsible for all the terrain inside the ski area boundary. So once we step outside the ski resort boundary, we are on our own. So even though we can see it and they can see us, that doesn't necessarily mean they're going to be there in a minute or two.
Gordon added, even though rescuers might be close by, significant dangers exist in attempting a rescue after a slide, particularly if the location is below other avalanche-prone terrain. The area must be safe before rescue crews enter. Speaking of the current snowpack, Gordon said extended periods of no new snow followed by a storm are particularly dangerous. With a relatively dry winter so far, when the snow does come, avalanche danger will be high. He says in addition to always having the proper avalanche gear, education, the most recent avalanche forecast for your area, and never venturing into the backcountry alone, avalanche avoidance is the most effective way to reduce the risk. In general, that means avoiding slopes steeper than 30 degrees and choosing not to ski or ride immediately after a storm or when forecasts indicate a significant risk of slides. Even though ski patrollers are not responsible for people who brave the backcountry, the community still sees a responsibility to better educate skiers and riders who pass through the gates into unpatrolled terrain. That's according to the Park City Professional Ski Patrollers Association's Cressa Pratt. The Ski Patrol Union co-hosted the event.
Our work as ski patrollers leads us to work mostly within our terrain boundary to help injured guests and mitigate avalanche problems, but we as a union recognize that we are part of a greater community of backcountry users and people who love to be in the mountains. And so we feel a responsibility to engage and educate with the community beyond the rope lines of our resort. Knowing what the snowpack is doing and knowing what to look for inbounds and out of bounds is important for everybody who's in the mountains.
The most recent local avalanche forecasts can be found on the Utah Avalanche Center website, utahavalanchecenter.org, and daily forecasts are broadcast every morning on KPCW. Sean Higgins, KPCW News.
Well, one of Park City's Main Street's most colorful characters, Carlene Riley, passed away on Monday morning. If you were one who got to enjoy her daily soup and sandwiches, consider yourself lucky. She owned Uptown Fair, where it was a fixture on Upper Main Street in the Star Hotel from 1999 until that building was condemned and she was forced to move in 2015. Seating was limited to about 20 people or so, and many times lunch was enjoyed at a table with people other than you arrived with. With the help of her fans, Riley moved Uptown Fair to the new location of the Kimball Arts Center on Kearns Boulevard and operated there for a couple of years before closing shop March 30th, 2018. For days before the closure, the restaurant was standing room only. It was the last chance to enjoy her famous tomato soup and roasted turkey or egg salad sandwich. In addition to her great home-cooked food, she was famous for her anti-Sundance stance, a story that even made it into the New York Times. Riley would only serve locals during the Sundance Film Festival because the Sundancers, she said, were too demanding and pushy. In an interview with KPCW back in 2018, she said she had to hire a bouncer to check IDs.
I had a big, huge black guy from England. He didn't know anything about Park City. When he took over the job, he was so excited. He got his picture in the paper. Tony was his name. And so he'd, are you, because they all have credentials. And he would say, nope, this is for locals only. And they'd walk away. And people would try to sneak in, do all kind of weird things, because then it really hit that it went out. And so the Sundancers started doing weird things to get in there, you know, taking off their credentials, taking off their black. I got over $1 million worth of PR off of that.
Riley had worked in restaurants most of her life. She also operated a catering business and worked as a private chef.
I was a good cook, so I was watching Oprah one day, and she says, hey, if you love what you do, you'll always be good at it. And I thought, yeah, I love to cook, so why don't I try it?
Her daughter Niven was the one responsible for making the famous egg salad sandwiches. Riley would laugh when people asked for the recipe of just three ingredients. It's hard-boiled eggs, mayonnaise, and salt. When she turned 70, she decided that she was tired and had a lot of other things that she wanted to do, so closed the restaurant.
That restaurant took up 15 hours a day, any way I looked at it, any way I sliced the pie. And people would always get mad at me for closing for 3 weeks, but it's like, hey, I got fridges to clean out. You know, I've got inventory. I've got a lot to do. And people just didn't understand that I was there. I never left that restaurant except for to go to Farmer's Market.
According to a post on the Uptown Fair Facebook page, Riley passed away at home Monday with her family, and it was noted that greater than her love of cooking for the community was her love of her family. She is survived by her husband, Kevin, three kids, and two grandkids. No memorial is planned until it's safe to do so. Condolences can be mailed to the family at Post Office Box 846, Oakley, Utah, 84055. Well, last week, nearly a third of all COVID-19 tests were coming back positive. This week, percent positivity has started to decline. KPCW's Jessica Lowell has more on the state and local COVID numbers.
The statewide seven-day rolling average for positive tests is nearing 28%, which is down from Tuesday's average. Summit County's seven-day average for positive lab tests is close to 27%, which is the highest the county has ever reported. And more than 32% of tests are coming back positive on average in Wasatch County. The Utah Department of Health announced almost 2,900 new COVID-19 cases Wednesday, which is almost 900 less cases than the state saw at the same time last week. The state saw an increase of over 12,000 new tests administered. Summit County has continued to see a rise in COVID-19 cases. The health department reported 64 new cases Wednesday. In comparison, last Wednesday, the health department reported 70 new cases. Wasatch County reported 53 new cases, which is more than twice the amount of cases the county saw last Wednesday. Utah's Department of Health reported 27 new deaths. However, 9 of the deaths reported happened before December 23rd. The department noted it can take a couple of weeks for medical examiners to investigate the cause of death. To date, almost 1,450 Utahns have died due to COVID-19, including 6 from Summit County and 16 from Wasatch County. Utah's Department of Health reported 101 new hospitalizations. There are 566 people in the hospital for COVID-19 in the state. Statewide, almost 93% of referrals under ICU beds are in use, which is up from Tuesday. More than 14,000 people were vaccinated for COVID-19 since Tuesday, bringing the total number to almost 125,000 first doses administered. Both Summit and Wasatch counties started vaccinating teachers this week. Jessica Lowell, KPCW News.
A Summit County attorney has been nominated for a vacancy on the 2nd District Court. Blake Hill has been a prosecutor in Utah for more than 2 decades. Earlier this week, he was nominated for the position by the 2nd District Judicial Nominating Commission. Hill is currently the special victim prosecutor for Summit County. Before working in the Wasatch Back, he worked at the Salt Lake County District Attorney's Office between 2000 and 2017. He graduated from the University of Utah's Quinney College of Law in 1998. Should he be selected, he would be replacing Judge Ernie Jones, who retires March 16th. Hill was nominated for the vacancy along with 4 other candidates. The commission is accepting written comments for the public, which can be sent to judicialvacancies@utah.gov. Following the public comment period, Governor Spencer Cox will have 30 days to make an appointment. Well, a string of instances where counterfeit bills were passed to Summit County retailers has been reported, all using fake $50 bills. KPCW's Sean Higgins has more on that.
The first reported counterfeit was on December 10th of last year when four fake $50 bills were used to pay for a Christmas tree at the Park City Nursery. Then on January 8th, another counterfeit $50 was reported at Park City Coffee Roasters. The most recent was just this week, with Smith's in Kimball Junction reporting four fake $50 bills from their January 11th sales. Summit County Sheriff's Lieutenant Andrew Wright says at the moment there appear to be no connections between the incidents other than them all involving $50 bills. He says counterfeit cash is extremely hard to track down.
As you can imagine, with counterfeit money, it can be very difficult for us to investigate for a few reasons. For instance, in the case of the four $50 bills that were passed at Smith's, they didn't realize until, you know, sometime later, a day or two later, after they had been passed, that they were in fact counterfeit. For a grocery store like Smith's that is so busy, that has hundreds if not thousands of customers coming through every week, it would probably be quite the task for them to track down.
That's Lieutenant Andrew Wright. Again, be on the lookout, and if you have a tip regarding these cases or other evidence of any counterfeit, please contact the Summit County Sheriff's Office at 435-615-3600. On the phone now, the Director of Youth Programs for the Youth Sports Alliance, Heather Sims, with details on some of the after-school programs being offered this winter. Good morning, Heather.
Good morning.
Okay, so what have you got? You've got programs underway at Park City, South Summit, Wasatch County, and Park City Day School.
Yes, last week we had 413 students participate in activities all around town in Deer Valley, at Park City Mountain, White Pine, Woodward, UOP, and the Ice Arena, as well as programs down in Wasatch County. And of those kids, 18% received scholarships. Our Alpine programs actually have about just under 30% that receive scholarships. And during these times, obviously people still want to get their kids out and doing things that they've never experienced before, or learning to improve on the skills that they already have. So it's been great. We've had, you know, we're very fortunate in the venues being able to allow us to still run programs in a safe manner. So we still have programs open for the February slots. We have this year it has been a little different because we're trying to keep, you know, the Alpine programs, which is our biggest program in a normal year, we're trying to keep them in their school pods. So this month we had Parley's Park and Jeremy Ranch do their Alpine program. And so next month we have Trailside and McPolin. And if anybody is still wanting to register for their kids to learn to ski or snowboard from those schools, they can register up till Tuesday next week.
Okay. You're still looking for some volunteers, though, to help out and make this work.
Yes, and because of our commitment to inclusion and social equity, you know, some of these families who are working full-time and cannot get their kids to the mountain, we are providing some SUVs from Trailside and McPullen to the resorts, and we are looking for some chaperones that would be able to help, and in return we would give them a lift ticket, or if they're not a skier, they would get a $30 compensation stipend. So if you are interested in helping us out and helping these kids get on the mountain and learn to ski, please email me at heather@ysaparkcity.org.
Okay. People can also get more information there just about the programs that you've got open for February as well.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention?
We have programs open for Activate as well. And so for those in the older age range, please, you know, check out the Activate programs on our website at ysaparkcity.org.
Okay. Heather, thanks for your time this morning. Heather Sims is the Director of Youth Programs for the Youth Sports Alliance.